I do have one question. I'm trying to assemble shiurim that I gave over the year for myself and to be able to put them on the site. If anyone has, I know you have things that you could.
I have here at April last 2 years or so, and sometimes.
Okay. Will you be able to get together? Okay. Thank you. And anyone has a chumash here, whatever.
And
as well as. Okay. Whatever you have, basically, I could. Yeah. So I hope everyone had a meaningful Tisha B'Av. The Chazal tell us that all of the fast days that commemorate the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash are going to be days of joy when there's a Beis. Not just neutral. It's not just the fast will be canceled, but they will actually be days of Simcha. So we hope, Ezras Hashem, that all of the mourning, all of the grieving that we did will make Tisha B'Av indeed a great, great day of Simcha. It's not going to be the last Tisha B'Av because the 9th of Av is always in the calendar, but it'll be the last Tisha B'Av of a fast. You know, they tell the story about a person who every year on Erev Tisha B'Av, he would go into a Sfarim store and he would buy a kinos. He would buy a new kinos. So the Sfarim store owner said to him, you know, I don't mind selling you a new book, but, you know, I know you bought it last year. Why do you buy it every year? He says, what do you mean? After Tisha B'Av, I put it in Seamus. I know I'm not going to use it again. If Chas V'Shalom, I have to do a new one. So I buy a new one. I put the old one in Seamus. Yes, sir. Did you want to say?
When the Mashiach comes, will we also have fast days then?
We will not. The only fast day we will have will be Yom Kippur. Even that is a bit of a machlokas. According to the Rambam, one of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith is that the Torah will never be nullified. So the Rambam says even when Mashiach comes, there's going to be all of the mitzvahs. That's one of the 13 principles of faith. On the other hand, there is another statement that says that all of the holidays are going to be nullified except for Purim, which would suggest that there won't be Pesach, there won't be the other holidays. So there seems to be a machlokas in Chazal. What is the status of Mashiach on mitzvahs? But the mainstream position is that mitzvahs will be kept. I guess you might ask a question. Okay, I understand mitzvahs are still going to be kept, but Yom Kippur is specifically because of sins that we commit. Will there still be sins when Mashiach comes? The answer is yeah. The answer is that when Mashiach comes, there will still be free will. There will still be bechira. So as paradoxically as it may sound, the same way people sinned when there was a Beis HaMikdash, they will sin when Mashiach comes as well, but we have a promise that it will never reach a level that would cause a destruction of that Beis HaMikdash. So theoretically, people will still do Averos when Mashiach comes. They'll have a much greater understanding of God, so as a result, their sins will not be, you know, as gross as our Averos are, but they will still do Averos, and therefore there will still be a Yom Kippur. But every other fast day, no, because all the other fast days are commemorating sorrows and suffering, and they become days of redemption when the Beis HaMikdash comes.
I read about a policy that the IDF has called the Hannibal Drive, the Hannibal policy, where it says that if a soldier is captured or in the process of being captured, that the IDF would have the choice to use force to either stop the kidnapping, even if it meant that what could happen is that the soldier might be killed in the attempt at stopping the kidnapping.
Right.
They don't say directly to kill the soldier rather than be kidnapped, but they have a policy of almost using force to stopping the kidnapping and the soldier dying might in some cases be better than the soldier being enemy.
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. This really comes out of the Gilad Shalit problem, where the enemy kidnaps somebody. We thought this other soldier was kidnapped. I don't know if I say Baruch Hashem or whatever, but he was killed instead by the enemy. But the problem is, they hold a person that's alive, and then they demand 1,000 terrorists to be released in order to get his release. And Israel then releases 1,000 terrorists into the general society, many of whom are going to kill again. And the issue becomes to release terrorists in exchange for one prisoner, you're saving one life and you're perhaps endangering 1,000 lives or 10,000 lives or even more. And as I think I mentioned other occasions, there's a very, very big machlokas haposkim. Are we allowed to free one person in a way that's going to endanger a lot of people? I don't know if you remember from Tisha B'Av, I mentioned yesterday the Maharam Mi-Rutenberg. Maharam Mi-Rutenberg was a great, great gadol, and he was kidnapped by some German nobility. Now, this was not part of a war. He was just held for ransom. They say, hey, pay us a lot of money, and we will let him go. And he paskened that they were not allowed to ransom him, because if they would ransom him, that would encourage other rabbis and other gedolim being taken hostage. And he said he was willing to leave himself in a matzav of sakana instead of endangering other people. Now, his own Talmud, the Rush, very much disagreed with his Rebbe. He said, you're the gadol hador, we have to ransom you. But the Maharam Mi-Rutenberg prevailed in that machlokas. So the question becomes, if we now have a situation where if somebody gets kidnapped, Israel is going to be given a demand to release 1,000 terrorists, so are we allowed to prevent that situation by either instructing the soldier to commit suicide, which is another possibility, that every soldier would have a cyanide pill or something in which they would just kill themselves? Or can we kill him? Or can we be so aggressive in a so-called rescue effort that in effect we know that he's going to die as a result? Those are hard shilas. I would say that the soldier is not allowed to commit suicide. That much is so. That's a big avera. Nor would we be allowed to kill him, because that's a maisa ritzicha. But I think it would be mutter to try to do anything that may have a chance to rescue him, even though it greatly increases the risks of danger to him. The analogy would be, are we allowed to do an operation? Let's take a medical analogy. Somebody's very, very sick, and there's a big risk they're going to die. We want to do a risky surgery, which if it works, the person is better, but there's a very high percentage that the person might die on the table. So there is a swara that as long as there's a chance that you might save him from his terminal illness, from his deathly illness, you are allowed to do so, even though there's a great risk that he's going to die. So I would say we might characterize the rescue effort that way. Now, in other words, the difference is if it's clearly just a suicide mission or a homicide mission, meaning essentially we just want to get the Arabs to kill him because we don't want to kill him, so we'll just do things so they'll kill him, I think that might be usher. If, on the other hand, it is a bona fide attempt at a rescue, then it would be mutter, even though it's highly risky. And Tebbe was an example of that. I don't know if you remember, it's before you were born. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu's brother, who died in the Entebbe raid, was the commander of that particular raid. And there you had a bunch of people who were taken hostage by terrorist organizations. And Israel lulled them into a false sense of security by basically agreeing to a release of prisoners. They agreed to it. But then, unbeknownst, they did a very sneak attack in the middle of the night. And it was really an amazing, amazing thing. I don't know if my memory fails me here. I believe none of the hostages were killed, but there was, unfortunately, some soldiers were killed, including Yonatan Netanyahu. He was the only one? He was the only one? It's amazing. He was the commander. So it just shows you, by the way, that Israeli commanders are not like the Hamas people who sit in their palaces and give orders for people to blow themselves up. Here the Israeli commander is there, and he's the one who gets killed. Again, it's a big tribute, I think, to the army, once again. So I would say the nafka mina is this an attempt to rescue? Or is this an attempt to get the guy killed so there won't be a Gilad Shalit problem, you know? And that would depend on the halachic acceptability. Yeah.
You spoke yesterday about Menashe, the King Menashe, and how terrible of sins that he caused causally. We have this call in the Torah that Hashem is not going to be near a person when they're involved in sin. That's one reason being in Eretz Israel is that Hashem is a little bit more removed from us, and there's a little less hashkacha pratis, but it gives us more leeway. As in when we were in the Midbar, if Yidden were sitting, there would be makot.
That's right.
So the question is, I was just wondering, how is it possible that there could be a Beis HaMikdash when we're doing such awful things. Like the Rav spoke that there wasn't even a Sefer Torah. They couldn't even find a Sefer Torah. The only teretz I thought of maybe was another thing the Rav said yesterday is that when the Nevi'im give Musar about the kings, so it's not really what it seems. Meaning Avodah Zarah and no Sefer Torah to be found in Eretz Yisrael would have meant like not everyone knew Kol HaTorah Kulo or something like that.
Yeah. The emphasis, I didn't make that point last night, but there are. In fact, I would urge you, all of you, I'm sure, have heard of Rabbi Avigdor Miller, who was Nifter a few years ago. Great, great Talmud Chacham and a great Baal Musar. He has thousands and thousands of tapes and CDs and 20 books. But he writes, one of the things that's very good, I mean, they're all good, is he writes authentic view of Jewish history. Meaning, he'll take Tanakh. He'll write it up the way Chazal understand it. So, one of the points he makes over and over again is that in spite of, exactly what you said, Yossi, in spite of the very, very negative portrayal of the Jewish people throughout the period of the First Temple, their sins, their idolatry, their murder, all of these big averas that we talk about, he says, in point of fact, it was always a small minority. In point of fact, he claims that the majority of the Jewish people were, in fact, righteous. They were, in fact, tzaddikim. And if Hashem speaks so harshly that the whole nation is evil, it is only because Hashem has a taina even on the tzaddikim, that why weren't they able to stop the evil? That's a very big indictment, that tzaddikim, Hashem has so much confidence in the power of tzaddikim that even if the tzaddikim are totally innocent, Hashem says you could have done more to stop. So that is one approach, meaning to say a lot of the biblical narrative is really only referring to a minority, and a majority, kept the Torah, they knew the Torah. And within the monarchy, maybe, they had not seen the Torah for a long time because of Menashe and the like, so it was a big chiddush, but in fact, the things were preserved. Another possibility, once again, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though it's true that the Averos drive away the Shekhinah, but it gets driven away in stages. So in point of fact, there was like an 800-year stage, meaning every single time. That's how the Beis HaMikdash gets destroyed. Gradually, 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 Hashem is withdrawing until you reach a point of zero, and then the Babylonians can come in and destroy the Mikdash. I just want to mention one interesting thing about Chizkiyo. We mentioned that Chizkiyo didn't want to have children. He was a righteous king. The Gemara in Brachos says he didn't want to have kids because he had a prophecy, or he saw with Ruach HaKodesh, that his son would be a Rasha. And indeed, he did get married, and he did have a son that was a Rasha. One of the questions that people might ask is, well, wait a second here. Are you telling me God decrees ahead of time that somebody's going to be a Rasha? Isn't that a fundamental contradiction? Menashe didn't have free choice. Menashe was Chizkiyahu's son. Menashe had to be a Rasha. Where does that go to free will? Now, good. Hashem knows the future. But once Hashem tells you he's going to be a Rasha, then at that point there's no Bechira once it comes out. So how do we understand the whole concept that somebody's a Rasha? So I think the only way to understand it intelligibly is that it's not that Menashe had to be a Rasha, but rather Menashe had a nature that was very prone to Averis. Menashe had a very, very strong Yetzer Hara. Now, and therefore, the tendency, unless there would be tremendous chizuk, would be he would go to sin. Chizkiyo's mistake was looking at that as a fait accompli, and I would like to say a little chiddush, that in a way, the reason Menashe became a Rasha is because Chizkiyo had convinced himself that this kid is a Rasha. Now, look at it from the perspective of a parent for a second. If you are convinced by a divine message that your child is going to be a sinner, then when your child does sins, like, there's no reason to correct him, no reason to stop him, no reason to educate him, because whatever I do isn't going to make a difference. In a sense, Chizkiyo's knowledge of the propensity to rishus of his son Menashe prevented him from doing what could have prevented Menashe from being a Rasha in the first place. Because we know that side by side with Menashe's Yetzer Hara was a tremendous, tremendous spiritual koach. It was side by side. The Yetzer Tov in a person is at least as strong as the Yetzer Hara. People who have strong Yetzer Haras also have strong abilities for good. The Gemara in Sanhedrin mentions that Menashe is one of the kings who does not have a share in Olam Haba. And the Gemara gives a story when the Chachamim were discussing how bad Menashe is. Menashe came to them in a dream and said to them, "Hey, ask me any shaila b'chalat harakula you don't understand, and I'll answer it." And they asked him shailas, shaila after shaila after shaila. He knew everything. He knew kalat harakula. He understood kalat harakula. So he was very, very great. He had godless. Hashem gave him a godless that could compensate and overcome that yetzer hara. But Chizkiyahu thought it wasn't worth the effort because Chizkiyahu thought it was a done deal. So in a way, we could say Chizkiyahu misinterpreted the information that he got from God. If Hashem tells you somebody's a Rasha, Hashem is not telling you he's going to be a Rasha. Hashem is going to tell you this person will have an unusual yetzer hara struggle in life, but you can still help him over it and the like. By the way, another thing that's very, very interesting is, you know, we have the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, which is the history of the monarchy until the Chorban Bayis Rishon, right? Until the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Babylonian exile. We then have another book of Tanakh, which is Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles. I don't know if you ever gave it a look. But, you know, Chronicles tells the same story. But, you know, it adds details, it subtracts details. Sometimes there are contradictions. It's very, very difficult. Because Divrei Hayamim is one of the hardest books to understand. Because if it repeats, the question is, why do I need to hear the same information? If it contradicts, I got a problem of contradiction, right? So when it's the same, it's a problem. And when it's different, there's a problem. But one of the fascinating differences between Malachim and Divrei Hayamim is in the story of Menashe. When I read the book of Malachim, Menashe is a Rasha mitchila v'yatsof. Menashe became a king at the age of 12. He ruled for 55 years. So although he didn't die that young, but, you know, he died 77, but he ruled for 55 years. That's the longest reign in Am Yisrael. There was no king who ruled that long. David ruled 40 years, Shlomo ruled 40 years, and many of the other kings ruled much less. Chizkiyahu ruled much less, 22 years. But Menashe, 55 years. In Book of Malachim, he was a Rasha mitchila v'yatsof. He died a Rasha, irredeemable. I look in Divrei Hayamim, and I see an amazing second act to Menashe's story. And it says that at some point, he was kidnapped, as it were, by the Babylonians. They didn't conquer Eretz Yisrael, but he himself was just kidnapped in a war, whatever it is, they took him. He was imprisoned, and in his imprisonment, he returned to Hashem with all of his heart and all of his soul. And Hashem, therefore, caused him to be released and become king again. And he died a righteous man. An amazing stira between Sefer Malachim and Divrei Hayamim. How do we understand the stira? How do we do? What was it? Did he die a Rasha? Or did he die of al-Shuva? So I saw one of the Mefarshim, one of the Bali Musar, Talmud of Yosalanter, offers a beautiful, beautiful explanation, a very deep explanation. He says the following. He says, and this explains a general hashkafa on the tachlis of the book of Malachim versus the tachlis of Divrei Hayamim. The tachlis of the book of Malachim is to describe people in their capacity as king, their political leadership, their decision-making, and the like. The tachlis of Divrei Hayamim is to describe them in their personal, individualistic lives. There is Menashe as king, and there is Menashe as person. So listen to this. Menashe as person is a Baal Shuvah Gomer. He did Shuvah. He returned to Hashem, v'chol levavo v'chol nafsha. But the problem is the following. Because Menashe was a melech, and because, as the Rambam says, the king is the heart of the nation, Menashe was not just a sinner. Menashe is the paradigm of Machti Yisrael. He was mashrish in Klal Yisrael. He created a massive Chilul Hashem. He created a whole society where people didn't care about mitzvahs anymore and they were willing to do the most disgusting things. He then becomes frum. Yeah, that's great. He becomes frum. What about, you know, the million people who left Hashem because of him? So Memela, Sefer Melachim, is touching up Menashe in terms of his legacy as Melech. His legacy as Melech was only riches, because Menashe could not be Mishana all of the Chilul Hashem that he caused. In Divrei Hayamim, it is Menashe as a Yochid. In other words, the basic point basically is that when you're not only a Chayte, but you're Machti as a Rabbim, right? Not only do you sin, but you cause many others to sin. Your tshuva helps for you, but your tshuva doesn't help for them. The evil that you perpetrated is still there. So that's why Menashe is described in those two different ways, in Divrei Hayamim and in Sefer Melachim. It's like the old story, it's the same mashal at least, where somebody asked the Chafetz Chaim, you know, how do you do tshuva on Lashon Hara? And I spread bad things about somebody, even if they're true, and for Keret, the emes is, it is actually harder to do Lashon Hara, tshuva on true Lashon Hara than it is on false. Because if I said, Rahman, it's a big avera, if I said something false about somebody, so theoretically at least, I could make a public statement, I was mistaken, what I said is not emes, etc. If I said something true about somebody, what am I supposed to say? Well, it's true, but I shouldn't have said, you know, in other words, the pagam to a person's reputation, that you can't take away at all. But the Chafetz Chaim's mashal, which he really applied to both types, really, is that he told the person, okay, I'll tell you how to do tshuva. Take a feather pillow, you know, pillows that in Europe were stuffed with feathers. Shake out the pillow from a roof, stand on a roof. Shake the feathers into the wind. He says, okay, what do I then do? Okay, put the feathers back, and then you'll have tshuva for Lashon Hara. You know, in this day and age, especially, it's even worse. You know, you have the social media, you have internet. You know, something comes out, the whole world, you know, can know about it. You know, in 15 minutes, whatever it would be. I'll tell you this: there have been internet suicides. This I know, meaning to say, somebody posted embarrassing information about a person. It got out. Person committed suicide. It happened. It's an interesting court case. They actually was a shiloh whether those people could be prosecuted for manslaughter because they caused somebody's death. Al pi halacha, probably not. It's a gairim. But, you know, the Rambam says that even a gram ritzicha, even though you don't get mises based in, is an issue deraisa v'lo sirtach. And even without that din of the Rambam, certainly if you're Malbim Pnei Chaver Barabim, if you embarrass somebody publicly like that, anyway you're called the right Seich, you know, just for that alone, even if he didn't commit suicide. But be it as it may, I just wanted to share with you with Menashe that there are these two dimensions in our lives. We are both individual people, but we are people who influence others. And sometimes our tshuva may work on one aspect, it does not work on the other aspect. Yeah.
Just a question on that. So we could say that the majority of things that are in Chumash and Tanakh are really about a specific minority.
This is what Rev Miller says. He basically, the truth of the matter is, I am not aware of a Chazal that makes that point befeirish. He gets it, Rev Miller got it, the Makor of Rev Miller's remarks were a sefer, Darius HaRishayim. Again, a fascinating sefer. It's never been translated. Maybe it'd be too difficult to translate. This was a historical work written by a person of Yitzchak Halevi Rabinovich, who was a Litvish Talmud Chacham, a big Talmud Chacham. In fact, he was like the chairman of the board. There was such a position of Volozhin, of the Yeshivas Volozhin. He was not a Rosh Yeshiva per se, but he was the Gabbai of Volozhin. Again, the chairman of the board. He was very Mekurev to the Nitziv. And even people who were earlier than the Nitziv. And he wrote, at a time of the Reform movement, he wanted to write, I'll just finish the sentence, yeah. He wanted to write a history that was Naaman to the Messiah of Chazal and Mekairis. And in the Darius HaRishayim, he makes this argument. But I'm not sure. I have to go. He does say this, but I have to go back and see. I'm not sure if he has any on that prat. If he has any chlor makaris, I think his proof basically is working backwards, like you said. You know, if Gan's Klal Yisrael were such Rishayim for so long, you know, why were they Zaycha to a Mikdash for so long? So, you know, he says it's not Yitachain, and therefore he wants to say there was only a Miyuta de Miyuta, that were Chayte, and the whole nation is Hashem because of Klal Yisrael Areven Zelazah. Yeah.
And could you say that's really the purpose of all the Masim that God chose to share? Like, my question is, really, if it's true, so why did God want to share that those specific mice and things that happened? Is that the whole the ikur of the Torah is really just kind of like,
well, you know,
there is like a few people.
Well, you know what they say. They say that at least in the Torah, that's Gufa, one of the great rayas, the Torah is min haShemayim. Because if we were writing our own story, we wouldn't put all the negative stuff in. You know, it's the Ribono Shel Olam, you know, paints us up often in the worst possible light. The worst of Eris, all of the chesroinus that we have, because the Torah was written by Hashem that we should get Musr, we should get Hadracha, we should learn about all of the things we could fall into and therefore how we can avoid them. It's not about patting ourselves on the back. Now, V'shteitzach, the Torah and the Nevi'im have numerous passages about Hashem's love for Am Yisrael, and it isn't all. I mean, Chas V'Shalom, we don't perceive the Ribono Shel Olam as telling us you're a bunch of junk, you know, you're garnished. I mean, for Keret, Hashem says over and over again that I am punishing you for your Averos because this is like a father to a son, this is a parent to a child. It is because I care about how you are that I makbid whenever you deviate from my drachim. So it comes from love. It's what we call tough love. It's a very, very tough love indeed. But it vadai comes from Hashem's love for us, that because He loves us, He doesn't let us go off the derech that much. When the Am Yisrael goes off the derech, you know, we get a big push to come back. Befrat in Eretz Yisrael, yeah.
I've been hearing a lot of like different things and like different thoughts and whatever about to expand possible. Like, what's Emunah?
That's a minute. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a question that you could ask a lot of different ways. What emuna is, as opposed to how you get it, that's a separate issue. Emuna is the belief system, the idea that I believe, although the word believe is ambiguous, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not only the creator of the world, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is involved in everything that happens in the world, that He cares and is involved and directs the lives of every individual and directs the fate of nations, and therefore we turn to Him as the source of all goodness, and we recognize that when there are troubles and tribulations, there are also messages sent from Hashem that we should grow from and we should learn from and we should do tshuva, you know, etc. Right, that is emunah. So emunah, now again, it says emunah per se is the intellectual belief, bitachon, is when you internalize it on an emotional level. Emunah and bitachon. So bitachon, we could say, is applied emunah. Like the Brisker Rav used to say, it's easy to have emunah when you have $100,000 in the bank. Of course, the Maisa, because of inflation, I think people would still have a problem with emunah, even with $100,000. Let's make it $1 million, whatever it would be. Bitachon is when you have nothing in the bank. You still have that same feeling. Now, how you reach it is a big machlokas. This is where maybe you'll see different things. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim teaches that one reaches emunah by intellectual philosophical argumentation, meaning to say you examine all of the arguments for or against God, and you should be convinced by the Bria, and you should be convinced by argumentation that the world could not have come by accident, that there must be a cheshbon, there must be a creator. And therefore the Rambam believed that a chelek of emunah is not simply being makabalit from your forefathers, your ancestors, but to do your own investigation. Right? That's leida. That's, in other words, emunah does not mean blind faith. Emunah means yediya, and yediya means a philosophical understanding of God that is compelling and logical. Other Rishonim did take a different approach. Other Rishonim took an approach that the way of knowing Hashem through philosophy was dangerous for two reasons, actually two separate reasons. Reason number one is, once a person opens up questions in order to come to the right answer, then chas v'shalom, who says you'll come to the right answer? In other words, it may make a person an apikoros who otherwise wouldn't have been. So if you're familiar with atheism and the like, so no, you have to explore. But if you're a person who's raised and you don't have so many shilas, we're not going to tell the person, oh, your chiyuv of emuna is to be doresh v'chaykin. That's one reason why it was considered dangerous. And indeed, that was part of why the guy to the perplexed was burnt. I mean, there were different, you know, machloksim about the Mora Nevuchim. That's why even today in our Beis Medrash, any Beis Medrash, we have the Mora Nevuchim somewhere buried in our Sameach. It's a chash of a sefer. We all respect it. Not that many B'nai Torah learn it. I know Rav Gottlieb, I think, is giving a shir now in Mora Nevuchim. Now, the second reason is a little different. The second reason is, and this was found, that during the Spanish expulsion, when Jews were given the choice, this was 1492. This is not mentioned in Kinos at all. Interestingly enough, there were two major catastrophes for Am Yisrael that are not mentioned in Kinos. Besides the Holocaust, which indeed there are some Kinos that were written for the Holocaust, even in the Art Scroll Kinos. You can see them. But two things that are not mentioned at all. The Crusades are mentioned four or five times. There are four or five kinos about the Crusades in the 1000s. But the Khmelnytsky massacre in the Ukraine, this killed hundreds of thousands of Jews. The Shachtite Khmelnytsky massacre in 1648. And there were, in fact, in many places in Europe, the 20th of Sivan was a tainis because of the Khmelnytsky massacres. And there were salichas for that day. And yet, there's no remez in Tisha B'Av to it. It's an interesting thing. It's not clear why. And the second is, there's no remez to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, although that actually happened on Tisha B'Av Gufa. So I don't know why those stories are not picked up, but what I want to mention is this. This will be a roundabout answer to your question. That there was one of the Gailim, one of the ones who was exiled, was a person known as the Chassid Yaivitz. Now, this is not Rav Yaakov Emden, later, the Chassid Yaivitz. He was a great tzaddik, a great gadol, and he wrote Meforshim on Pirkei Avos. He wrote Sifrei Musar. So he knew many of the Jews in Spain. He lived there. He was there. And he said that those Jews whose connection to Hashem was philosophical and intellectual, when the pressure came and the goyim say, convert to Christianity or I'll kill you, they converted. Their intellectual belief in Hashem was not enough to be Moser Nefesh, Al Kiddush Hashem. And those Jews who had what is called Emunah Pshuta, unquestioning faith, they were willing to be either leave Spain or they were willing to die. They were willing to be Moser Nefesh. So there is a concept that when we make too much of our life based on intellectualism, it doesn't always penetrate our emotional being. And if it doesn't penetrate our emotional being, so when life is without challenges, okay, no, I can live that way. But when there are challenges, that's why, to take another example, that's why in Nazi Germany, you know, there was a great philosopher. He was a great philosopher, Martin Heidegger. Absolutely one of the world's greatest, he's not alive anymore, one of the world's greatest philosophers. And, you know, he taught about, humanity and all those things. He became a Nazi because it was, you know, he couldn't survive the pressure. So that's why there's some shaila whether Heidegger should be studied in Jewish universities, whatever it is. Right? So some say, like Acher and Rabbi Meir, you separate the teichen from the person, etc. So because of this, there is a big machlokas if emuna should be based on intellectualism, or emuna should be based on just my faith in Hashem. But what it is, I think, is not so much of a machlokas. How you get there is a machlokas. What it is my belief not only that Hashem is a bore, but Hashem is a manhig. He runs the world. What happens in this world is an expression of the ratzon of Hashem. And therefore, I can turn to him because he will listen to me. Maybe not give me what I want. He may listen to me and say no, that we know, but he is there for me to turn to.
Is one able to stimulate bitachon through learning? It seems like learning would more help your intellectual
mood. Yeah.
But with bitachon, it seems like you may take a different approach.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Torah has both a rational component and a metaphysical component. Mm-hmm. Obviously, learning Torah develops our mind. Right? You go through Gemara, you go through Svara, you go through different chains of reasoning. And on a rational level, really all it's doing is working on our mind. But not really. There is a whole metaphysical aspect of Torah, and that is, since HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Seichel and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Metzias is one, because Hashem is an indivisible unity, so it's not Hashem has a Seichel and Hashem has something else. You know, everything within HaKadosh Baruch Hu is one. So when you're miyached, when you unify yourself to God's intellect, as expressed in the Torah, you are connecting yourself to God's Metzias. And as a result, learning actually infuses your neshama with Kedusha, with Devekas. Devekas is cleaving to Hashem. And as a result, it can help you in Bitachon as well. It can help you in every single level. Now, I'm not going to say that's the only thing that you need. Tefillah is actually a very, very big builder of Bitachon. And life is a big builder of Bitachon. You know, one of the great Bali Musar of Chaska Levenstein, who was the Mashgiach of Mir during World War II in Shanghai, and he later came to Eretz Yisrael, and he was a Mashgiach in Panovich. Great, great, phenomenally great tzaddik. He had daughters. He didn't have sons, and he did not teach his daughters Gemara. He didn't have the more modern thing that people do. But one of the things that he would teach his daughters was every day they had to identify three things in their lives that represented a Kadosh Baruch Hu caring about them. And they couldn't just be the things like, oh, I can walk. I mean, those things all we have to remember. I can walk, I can breathe. That for sure we have to think about all the time. But something special, something unique that shows Hashem cared about you today. And that could be a lot of things. You know, and even these are small things. A person is really, really thirsty. And they see a place where they can get a drink, which, you know, maybe they didn't notice before. Or a person, you know, gets a bus on time. Otherwise, it would have been a two-hour wait. This is hashgacha, hashgacha. And the more you learn to look at your life that way, the more you learn bitachon. Bitachon is practice. Because Hashem is helping us all the time in so many ways. But, you know, we take things for granted. We don't look. But vis-a-vis your question, I would have to say, remember that the Torah itself is the biggest. If you ever looked at the fourth shar of the Nefesh HaChaim, which is, I would have to say, it's almost the manifesto of B'nai Torah, like the official statement of why do we learn? And he goes on, it's pretty long, 30 prakim. A lot of it is based on Zohar and Kabbalah. But he goes over and over and over again how Talmud Torah creates a Devekas Bashem. And once you're Dovuk in Hashem, your neshama can get purified. Now, this is why there were some people who were against, some Gedalim, who were against Rav Yisrael Salanter's approach. Rav Yisrael Salanter, in the middle of the 1800s, developed a Shita of Musar, where you have to work on your Midos and you have to learn about Bein Adam L'Chaveira. And there were some Gedalim, who were very strongly opposed to Rav Yisrael Salanter, because they basically said, all you need is Torah learning. You learn Gemara, you learn Kesayis, you learn Rabbi Kiva Eger. That's going to purify you. What do I need to learn Musar Svar? Now, there were those that had that Shita. The Chafetz Chaim said that Torah is all you need if you have a healthy soul. If a person has a healthy body, you live on a healthy diet. But when you have sickness, you need medicine in addition. So he said, we have sick souls, so we need to focus specifically on the Inyanim of Musar as well. We need that as well. But when your soul is relatively healthy, the Torah will give you everything. It will give you bitachon. It will give you midos, right? But you have to learn it with the right devotion. You don't learn it for gaiva. You don't learn it to show up. You learn it because it's the Torah's Hashem. And then you connect to Hashem and it can purify you. So this is why people don't understand yeshiva sometimes, you know. What would be the English translation of a yeshiva? So people think a theological seminary. That, in fact, that's how yeshivas are translated in America. You know, So my yeshiva is either rabbinical college. That's not really accurate because yeshivas not only do you train rabbis, or theological seminary. Now, Goyim have theological seminaries. But what's kind of funny is you come to yeshiva, you know, we don't spend the day. What is theology? Theology is, things about God and things about, You know, Derech Hashem is a book of theology. Derech Hashem, wonderful sefer, and Baruch Hashem, we have Shiurim in Derech Hashem. But we don't spend the whole day learning Derech Hashem. In other words, if you were to ask what we spend most of our day doing, it is not theology. In fact, as bizarre as this may sound, the closest analogy to what we're doing is going to law school. Because, you know, you're learning different cases, and can this case be reconciled with this case? And sometimes a person might feel, where is the spirituality in this? It's so technical, it's dense, and we're talking about cheaters and guys who want to divorce their wife by throwing something at her and not telling her what it is, and is that valid? Or some wild animal gets out and mauls somebody, do I have to pay? It's not on its face. What I'm saying is, it's not on its face what you would consider to be spiritual things. It's not lofty things. But Rav Chaim Volozhiner says that by connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah and by applying the Torah to the nitty-gritty of life, it's nice, to be like, isolated from the world and just ponder Hashem. But we live in a world of people who divorce their wives and wild animals and liars. And the test of Ruchnius is not how spiritual you are when you separate yourself from all of those things, but can you bring Kedusha to real life? And then we have the metaphysical idea that any chelik of Torah I learn is Mekashrim me to Hashem. It's a hard idea because it's not a rational idea necessarily. That's why Rav Chaim Volozhiner brings everything from Kabbalah, but it's connected to the mystical unity of Hashem and my soul being Mekusher to Hashem through his Ratzon as expressed in Torah. So that's why we don't learn a lot of, we learn theology, so to speak, but we don't spend the whole day on theology. We spend the whole day on Lemaisa. You might call it applied theology. How do you apply all of these beautiful ideas about God to this real world, which is often sordid and nasty and, not the greatest world? Yeah.
With the murder of the three teenagers, leading up to it, before it was revealed that they
were killed right away, yeah.
Lots of tefillah and learning and whatnot. Granted, the Kalei Yisrael didn't know at the time that the teenagers were dead, but I don't understand the fact that those tefillahs were asking Hashem for something that was already a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
At a bigger level, how do we view Hashgachah? We tefillahs that go towards something that already happened.
Well, obviously, to be mispal on something that already happened, as the Gemara says, as the Mishnah says, is that tefillah shav. But once again, no tefillah goes to waste. The Stifler used to say, based on earlier Makairis, that when Klal Yisrael comes together and prays to Hashem, those tefillahs go into a storehouse of sechus that is matzil am Yisrael from tzara after tzara after tzara. Now you may say, okay. But for these kids, it didn't mean anything. The answer actually is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted those Kedoshim to have a tremendous Sechus. He wanted them to go to Gan Eden with not only the Sechus of dying Al Kiddush Hashem, which they did, but have the Sechus of being Gairim Am Yisrael to come together with Achdus and Tefillah. If you think about the Achdus that was created among all segments of the Jewish people during those 18 days when we were hoping they were alive. But you have to know, all of that is going to go to the zchus of those neshamas. Those neshamas were goring that we came together. It was the Ratzon Hashem that those neshamas should have that zchus, because that will bring them higher and higher. So if you ask me, did our tefillos help them? The answer is absolutely, because it all becomes their zchus. Yeah, I'm sorry, you just have to run through another share.